thank you very much. Thank you to John and Martin for the invitation to come and talk today. Apologies in advance, I've got a bit of a cough at the moment, so if I have a kind of Theresa May style meltdown, just bear with me and I will get back to you as soon as possible. So, the historiography of international health, or global health, we can talk about the differences later on if we want to, has tended to focus on the work of international organisations, or Western philanthropic groups, and of experts from Europe and North America. This is the familiar international health history of the Rockefeller Foundation, the League of Nations Health Organization, the WHO, and of global health NGOs. Implicit in many of these histories is the association of international health with liberal principles and institutions, with humanitarian actors, and with progressive political and social movements. Now, these international bodies and liberal internationalists did undoubtedly play a key role in the modern history of international health, but they only form part of that story. What I want to do today is to ask what this history looks like if we adopt a different perspective. Recent research has begun to explore modern international health cooperation beyond the confines of these liberal institutions and societies. So Dora Varga, for example, is recovering the overlooked history of socialist international health during the Cold War. What I want to do is today is to explore this history from the other end of the political spectrum, from the point of view of Franco's Spain, and to ask what this history of international health looks like through the perspective of the authoritarian right. So why the Franco regime? Certainly not because of its intrinsic importance. Spain had played an important role in international health during the 1920s and the 1930s. Spanish health experts, for example, had worked closely with the League of Nations Health Organization, and the Rockefeller Foundation's International Health Division had also played an influential role in helping to train and expand the Spanish public health profession. Indeed, many of the leading Spanish public health experts had been Rockefeller fellows during the 1920s and the 1930s. This engagement kind of reached its peak during the Second Republic in Spain between 1931 and 1936, and then expanded again during the Spanish Civil War, when a range of international health and humanitarian organisations provided support to both the Republican and the rebel zones. After 1939, however, Spain's role in international health was a much more peripheral one. But the Franco regime, I think, provides a unique perspective from which to examine its history, not least because of the longevity of the regime. Emerging from the milieu of European authoritarian and fascist movements in the 1930s, the regime built close ties with the Axis powers during the Spanish Civil War and the Second World War, survived the transition to a liberal world order after 1945, and exploited the divisions of the Cold War to re-establish itself as a semi-integrated member of the international community. As such, it allows us to examine not just individual organisations, not just individual international organisations or movements, or even particular moments of international health cooperation, but the interaction and relationship between the multiple and competing forms of international health which transcended the period. Although Franco-Spain played a relatively marginal role in the field of international health, this does not mean that international health wasn't seen as important by the Franco regime or by the Spanish experts who worked within it. As those of you who came to the talk earlier this year on Francoist hospitals will know, the Spanish health system during the period was inefficient, fragmented, and chronically underfunded. During the 1940s and the early 1950s, Spain experienced a series of typhus and tuberculosis epidemics, as well as widespread hunger and starvation. Nevertheless, health and welfare were central to the regime's efforts to establish its legitimacy in the aftermath of the Spanish Civil War. This was true both on a domestic level, where the regime sought to capture the support of the masses by promoting itself as a social state and demonstrating its commitment to social progress and social justice. But it also applied on the international stage, where the regime sought to position itself as a socially just, scientifically advanced, and humanitarian state. With that in mind, both Franco's politicians and health experts were keen to engage in international work. The shifting geopolitical dynamics of the era, however, meant that the reality of what international health involved during the period was constantly changing. This paper is going to examine some of the key ways in which Francoist health experts cooperated beyond their national borders, focusing on their work on the 1940s and the 1950s. The first of these forms of international cooperation we might dub fascist international health. During the Second World War, Spanish experts mainly focused their attention on Nazi Germany, taking part in the various forms of international health cooperation organised under the auspices of the Nazi New Order. The second was its involvement in post-war liberal international health organisations. I've put liberal in inverted commas because I don't really think that it's the right phrase to describe organisations like the WHO, but I'm trying to distinguish them from the other types of international health. After the war, a fierce debate raged over whether Spain should be admitted to the WHO. The country was ultimately excluded for 6 years, but the controversy surrounding the issue illustrates the ways in which authoritarian regimes can exploit the idea of international health as a technical and apolitical field to further their political goals. The third were imperial and post-imperial health networks. Beyond the WHO, Spanish experts built networks of cooperation around their small colonial territories in Africa and around their former imperial relationships in Latin America. This involved cooperation with other imperial powers and the promotion of new regional patterns of health cooperation based on the ideas of a shared history, language, culture, and religion. And the last was Christian, or more specifically, Catholic international health. Cooperation between Catholic humanitarian and health organisations proved one of the most fruitful ways for Francoist experts to work internationally during the early stages of the Cold War. And after I've been through these various forms of international cooperation, I'll end by trying to draw together some conclusions about what these forms of international health tell us about the wider history of international health and internationalism in the mid-20th century. Fascist international health. We know from the work of people like Paul Weindling and Robert Proctor that medicine and public health were central to the fascist project. What's perhaps less well known is that fascist powers were also involved in intensive international cooperation. The foundations for this international cooperation were laid during the interwar period, particularly in public health cooperation between Nazi Germany and fascist Italy. So the first two pictures you have here at the top were actually, I think, from around 1940, but show Leonardo Conti, who was the Reich Health Minister, visiting health institutions in fascist Italy. This cooperation began in the early 30s, but was formalised in May 1937, when the Reich Medical Association drew up an agreement with the Italian Ministry of Public Health to establish a joint German-Italian medical commission, with the goal of strengthening the relationship between the German and Italian medical professions. The agreement sought to coordinate the work of delegates at international conferences, to promote research and study exchanges, to arrange translation of medical texts, and the exchange of medical journals and literature. These German-Italian links would later act as the fulcrum for wider forms of wartime health and welfare cooperation across Axis-dominated Europe. And Spain was involved with these relationships as well. Spanish experts had been studying in Germany since the beginning of the 20th century, and had traditionally regarded it as the centre of European science and medicine. For their part, the German medical and scientific professions had been working to strengthen links with Spain and other neutral countries since the aftermath of the First World War. During the Spanish Civil War, leading right-wing Spanish experts such as the psychiatrist Antonio Vallejo Nogueira, who some of you may have heard of, forged close ties with their German counterparts. You can see the bottom picture here is a group of German medical experts visiting a Spanish health insurance, Francoist health insurance centre, again in the early 1940s. After the outbreak of war in 1939, and particularly after the Axis invasion of the Soviet Union in 1941, these embryonic examples of international health cooperation were integrated into Nazi efforts to promote the idea of a new order for Europe under Nazi leadership. During the early stages of the Second World War, Spain was broadly aligned with the Axis powers, officially declaring itself non-belligerent rather than neutral in 1940. Franco's offer to formally join the Axis military coalition was rejected by Hitler, but Spain did send the Volunteer Blue Division to fight alongside Axis troops on the Eastern Front. And Spanish experts played a prominent role in the forms of international health cooperation promoted under the auspices of the Nazi New Order. Perhaps the most striking example of this was the International Tuberculosis Conference held in Berlin in November 1941. And this is an image of some of the leading figures from both Italy and Germany who took part in the conference. Unfortunately, I haven't found any better picture of the conference, but I'm sure they exist somewhere. Over 50 health officials and experts representing 20 different states, although obviously what was a state in 1941 in Europe was slightly different from what was a state before and after the war, met to discuss how to combat the rapid spread of tuberculosis across Europe since the start of the war. And they agreed to form a new international association against tuberculosis, who these gentlemen here would be the leaders of. Now, on the surface, the conference looked like a straightforward example of the kind of international health cooperation that had become increasingly common since the 19th century. Delegates spoke of the need to find international solutions to international problems. They discussed plans for world conferences, for an international journal, and for ongoing scientific exchange. The difference, of course, was the context in which the conference occurred. Organised at the invitation of the Reich Health Office, it encompassed only Axis, occupied or neutral states, and took place within the midst of the European public health crisis provoked by the Nazi war effort and occupation. Now, the largest delegation of the conference came from Spain, and the Spanish Director General of Health, José Palanca, who we'll hear more about later, was appointed as the new association vice president. His visit to the conference was part of a wider 2-month study tour, which he undertook with a group of other Spanish health experts to study public health within the Nazi New Europe. So they, for example, visited lots of typhus control centres and studied the design of health insurance systems. The extensive ties between Spanish social experts and Spanish health experts in Nazi Germany were based in part on the traditional prestige of German science and medicine and on the historical links between Spanish and German scientific communities. But the popularity of the Nazi New Order among Spanish experts also reflected shared beliefs about the nature and role of public health. Spanish experts who attended the tuberculosis conference and the 1941 tour lauded the arrival of a new era of what they called totalitarian public health and totalitarian social insurance, in which the traditional liberal focus on the individual would be replaced by an interest in the health of the national collective, of the Volk, or of the race. It also reflected a widespread belief that the future of international cooperation and exchange would take place within an Axis-dominated world. The Nazis' use of internationalist language and practices helped to secure the support of European experts from across the European right. Many of the delegates at the 1941 conference, for example, had been involved with pre-war international health organisations, such as the League of Nations Health Organisation or the International Union Against Tuberculosis, and would go on in the post-war era to work with organisations like the WHO and UNICEF. These forms of fascist international health were, of course, beset by tensions and contradictions. Nazi geopolitics, to the extent it could be clearly defined, projected theories of world order based on racial struggle between nations, international hierarchies and regional hegemony. The relationship between Spanish health experts and Nazi Germany reflected this. It was complicated by divergent attitudes towards religion, race and eugenics, but also, and probably more importantly, by German hegemony and Spain's subservient position within the hierarchical realities of the new order. The new forms of international health, which briefly emerged then within Nazi-dominated Europe, had little practical or scientific impact and were unavoidably anchored in Nazi efforts to reshape Europe according to its own interests and ideology. But examining them within the wider history of 20th century international health is not to suggest that this context was in some way peripheral or that there was any ideological affinity between liberal international health of the pre-war era and the Nazi New Order. What it does do, however, is highlight the entanglements and parallels between the two phenomena, not least from the perspective of many of the actors involved. It also illustrates how the habits of acting and thinking internationally, which have been embedded through the growth of international health organisations and networks prior to the war, serve to underpin support for the idea of a reformed and reformulated international health system under the Nazi leadership. Let's move on to liberal international health organisations, although, as I said, I'm not entirely wedded to that definition. So many of the same Spanish experts who cooperated with Nazi Germany during the war were also active participants in the work of liberal international health organisations, and particularly with the new system that emerged around the WHO after the Second World War. And actually, many of the people who had been most closely involved with Nazi Germany had also, at the same time during the Second World War, continued to work with organisations like the Rockefeller and the League of Nations health organisations. The Rockefeller Foundation, its international health division in particular, had been keen to carry on working with Franco Spain after the Spanish Civil War, partly because of the opportunity it provided to learn how to deal with public health emergencies in the aftermath of modern warfare. They were obviously thinking about with the work that they would have to carry out after the eventual end of the Second World War. Seeing Spain as a laboratory for post-war emergency health relief, they carried out studies on nutrition and typhus after 1939, only reluctantly stepping away from them after America's formal entry into the war in 1941. Rockefeller officials were also motivated by their pre-existing relationships with Francoist health experts, such as José Palanca, who you can see there, who I mentioned before. Crucially, they felt that they had a duty to prioritise the needs of the Spanish people over political objections to their involvement with a fascist regime. As such, they were keen to support those Spanish experts who were apparently committed to keeping politics out of public health, and did their best at public health and to pursuing health work for its own sake. Palanca was very aware of these views and did his best to present himself and his colleagues as moderate upholders of independent health work in the face of the unreasonable political demands of extremist elements within the Francoist coalition. And this idea of a distinction between political issues on the one hand and the apolitical ideals of international health also dominated post-war debates about Spanish membership of the WHO. During the foundation of the WHO in 1946, many of the key figures involved in drawing up plans and the constitution were experts who had played a leading role in international health prior to the Second World War. So men like Ludwig Rachmann, André Stamper and Jacques Parizeau had all held senior positions within the League's health organisation. They were proud of its achievements and were keen to ensure its positive features were retained in the post-war era. However, they were also keenly aware that the organisation's of the organisation's weaknesses, particularly its position within the wider League of Nations system, which had made it vulnerable to the political divisions which beset the League during the 1930s. The fate of the League's health organisation, argued Stamper in 1946, demonstrated, quote, the danger of political connections for technical institutions. And the only way for the WHO to avoid the same fate, he argued, was to ensure that it was established as a non-political body. And that was the phrase he used, non-political. The early history of the WHO, when the organisation was abandoned by the communist states and buffeted by the forces of the emerging Cold War, suggests that their plans to create a non-political body failed to some extent. And the debate about Spanish membership, which ran from 1946 until 1951, helps to explain, I think, how and why this happened. The arguments over universal membership, which became a proxy for the question of Spanish participation, reflected a struggle between, on the one hand, international health experts, and on the other, nation states, over the nature of the WHO, and particularly the success of the latter in establishing their control of the new organisation. The debate about Spanish membership played out during the course of the complex set of committees, conferences and negotiations leading up to its creation in July 1946. At the Technical Preparatory Committee, which was held in Paris in February, a group of seasoned international health figures, formerly acting as independent experts rather than government representatives, promoted this idea of a non-political health organisation, which they felt should operate at arm's length from the UN, and which would be genuinely universal. But at the International Health Conference, which followed and was held in New York in June, and which was responsible for drawing up the WHO's constitution, These arguments for political independence and universal membership were gradually undermined by the representatives of national governments. The question of Spanish membership proved so contentious mainly because it coincided with the wider so-called Spanish question at the UN, in which the major powers were debating the future of Franco-Spain in the post-war world. As a result, and despite the dreams of those experts who had envisaged the WHO as a universal apolitical organisation, Franco-Spain was excluded from the WHO on overtly political grounds. But despite these bitter conflicts, Spain was admitted to the UN just 5 years later, in 1951. Its entry reflected not a renewed commitment to removing politics from international health, but the improved international standing of the Franco regime. So the development of the Cold War had shifted the focus away from Franco's complicated fascist past towards his impeccable anti-communist credentials. And the withdrawal, in particular, of the Soviet Union and its Eastern Bloc allies from the WHO removed the most vocal opposition to Spanish entry. Addressing the World Health Assembly for the first time in 1951, which is what you can see in the picture here, and remember this is just 10 years after he had attended the Nazi tuberculosis conference in Berlin, José Blanco told delegates that, quote, "Spain ardently desired to become a member of the World Health Organization. Our country has never omitted to fulfill its obligations in matters of welfare work, humanitarianism, and health on the international level. It was not Spain which obscured our international obligations in matters of health and welfare by considerations of political differences, largely of a passing nature." End quote. After this point, Spain was rapidly and relatively unproblematically integrated into the work of the WHO and the wider UN system. The fierce debate over Spanish membership, I think, serves to illustrate some of the tensions inherent in post-war international health, particularly between the universalist rhetoric of the new WHO system and the political realities of global conflict and political exclusion. During the post-war apogee of internationalism, as Glenda Sluger has called it, many hoped the WHO would be able to overcome the political divisions which beset the League's health organisation in the interwar period. Functionalists argued that practical cases of international cooperation, as in the field of health, could help to build a new global society from the bottom up. And their goals were reflected in the language of the WHO's constitution, which argued, as you will know, that, quote, "the health of all peoples is fundamental to the attainment of peace and security and is dependent upon the fullest cooperation of individuals and states," end quote. However, the United Nations and its technical agencies, like the League before it, had emerged from a wartime coalition. And the discussion about the status and role of ex-enemy countries, like Spain, and ex-enemy was the phrase that was used during these debates to refer to places like Spain, Germany, and Italy, reflected the contradictions between its partisan origins and its post-war claims to universalism, as did the ongoing controversies surrounding the status of colonial territories. The UN structure ensured that the dominance of the great powers and of national governments over technical agencies. The emergence of the Cold War quickly transformed the WHO into a site for global political and ideological conflict during the 1950s and the 1960s. Its work shaped by the strategic goals of the US on the one hand, and by the opposition and withdrawal of the Soviet Union and its allies on the other. But Spanish experts didn't just run blindly into the embrace of organisations like the WHO in the post-war era. They also sought to develop new patterns of international cooperation where the Franco regime's political background would prove less of a hindrance and where it could play a more unproblematic and prominent global role. And in particular, Spanish health officials and experts saw colonial health and health cooperation within its former colonial territories as a key means to develop an autonomous and influential role within the field of international health. Spain's post-war empire was of extraordinary symbolic value to the Franco regime, but was in fact very, very small, consisting of a strip of northern Morocco, a largely uninhabited region of the Western Sahara, and the territory called Spanish Guinea, which is present-day Equatorial Guinea. But despite its relative insignificance and the brutality and neglect which characterised Spanish colonial rule, The Franco regime sought to promote Spain as a responsible European colonial power committed to African development. And health and welfare experts were at the heart of this process. Their professional training and research in the fields of colonial health and tropical medicine brought them into contact with networks of colleagues from Europe and North America. Their work on the ground in Africa required them to participate in the inter-imperial networks of public health set up to prevent the spread of infectious diseases. For many, both inside and outside of the profession, colonial health symbolised both the virtues of the Francoist social state and Spain's claim to be a civilised and civilising imperial power. A leading figure in Spanish colonial health of the period describes Spanish health experts working in Africa as, quote, those who go out of their way in the colony to demonstrate both to neighbouring colonies and to the whole world that Spain continues to be the generous, selfless, civilising and evangelising nation it has always been. End quote. When Spain began to gain entry to post-war international health organisations like the WHO, its status as an imperial power seemed to promise Spanish experts a role within the regional structures set up to promote African health and development, for example, the regional African Regional Office of the WHO. But despite the rhetoric of the Franco regime, the limited size of its colonies and the obvious failings of Francoist colonial rule restricted Spanish experts to a marginal role. They were largely excluded, importantly, from the more formal inter-imperial health networks established after 1945, such as the Combined Commission for Technical Cooperation in Africa. This in turn limited their role in the regional work of international health and development organisations during the 1950s. Perhaps more importantly than this, this kind of African perspective, however, were Spain's former colonial territories in Latin America, where the Franco regime also sought to promote the image of Spain as a technically, economically, and socially advanced state. Again, health and welfare experts were at the forefront of these efforts, attempting to establish new regional health networks within which Spain would be able to play a leading role. A good example is their work in the fields of health insurance and social security. Despite the stark inadequacies of the newly introduced Francoist health insurance system, which again you will know about if you were at the seminar earlier in the year about Spanish hospitals, Francoist officials and experts sought to establish Spain as a model for the development of health insurance and social security across Latin America. They did so by creating a new Ibero-American community of social security experts, beginning with what you can see here as the first Ibero-American Social Security Conference held in Madrid in 1950. This was one of the first major international conferences ever to be held in Franco Spain and was attended by delegations from over 20 states and international organisations, including a number of overseas government ministers. As well as providing the Franco regime with an international platform on which to promote its social credentials, the conference also agreed to establish a new Ibero-American Commission of Social Security, based in Madrid and led by Spanish experts. In 1954, it was transformed into the Ibero-American Organization for Social Security, which, as you can see here, is an organization that still exists. Its former role was to promote the coordination and exchange of expertise and the international collaboration of experts, with a focus on developing the distinct, quote, spiritual and ethical character of social security in the region. Its headquarters remained in Madrid, and its Secretary General was a Spanish lawyer and social security expert who had been one of the leading promoters of Ibero-American cooperation in the 1940s. The idea of Ibero-American cooperation in the field of health insurance was not entirely rhetorical, and Spain did enjoy a limited degree of success in promoting its social and health model across Latin America. Latin American delegations, for example, to the regular OISS conferences were generally headed by health or social security ministers, providing Spain with the opportunity to promote its health and social model to influential Latin American audiences. The OISS also organised training courses in Madrid for Latin American experts. And although most countries in Latin America, so for example, Chile and Uruguay, already have fairly well-established health and welfare insurance systems and had next to nothing to learn from the Spanish model. A few states with relatively underdeveloped systems, such as Bolivia, Ecuador, or El Salvador, did seem to try and to take some lessons from the Spanish case. They all, for example, received technical assistance from the OISS during the 1950s, which consisted of teams of Spanish experts providing support in drafting new health insurance legislation and health insurance reforms. But, of course, the success of these efforts should not be exaggerated. The Franco regime's overtly politicized use of the OISS to promote its interests and image in Latin America limited its effectiveness as a genuine forum for multi-directional exchange. And more broadly, Spanish attempts to forge these kind of post-imperial Ibero-American communities had a complicated reception in Latin America. For some Latin American elites, the idea of a strengthened Ibero-American community offered commercial, political, or personal opportunities. But other countries also claimed to a special relationship with Latin America, whether France or Italy, with their vision of transnational Latin communities, or the Portuguese language of Luso-tropicalism. These in turn competed with the input of the United States and the hemispheric vision of Pan-Americanism. But most importantly, Spanish experts... Spanish efforts to create a distinct form of Ibero-American health corporation was also opposed by Latin Americans who resented the neo-imperialist undertones of Spanish projects. So what you can see here is an image, a map, drawn up by an organization called Salus Infirmorum, which you'll hear more about in a second, which is a Spanish nursing association. They're depicting efforts by the organization to set up networks across Latin America and to link Latin America to Spain. But the way they do that is to juxtapose the symbol of their organizations with the ships of the conquistadors leaving, going to Latin America in 1492. And the Spanish vision, as the Spanish vision of Hispanidad or Spanishness became, or Hispanicness became increasingly associated with the political right, so hostility among Latin American liberals and leftists grew. When one prominent Spanish health expert toured the continent in the 1940s, he was met with cries of, "Fascist, we don't want Francoists here." Let's then turn to the final and arguably one of the most important ways in which Francoist experts engaged with international health, which was Christian and specifically Catholic health. The Francoist social state was conceived and presented as a project underpinned by Catholic values. Catholic internationalism was one of the primary ways through which Franco-Spain engaged with the outside world during the immediate post-war period. Unlike secular international organisations and networks, Spanish experts were warmly welcomed within many of these Catholic international structures. The historical prestige of Spanish Catholicism and the global Catholic mobilisation in support of Francoist forces during the Civil War ensured a broad sympathy for the Franco regime amongst the global Catholic community. Within this context, Christian international health organisations and the wider network of international Catholic organisations and NGOs, which played an important role in the post-war international system, provided an ideal forum for Spanish experts to promote a positive image of Franco Spain to the global Catholic community. Catholic international health, at least from the Spanish perspective, was an ambiguous phenomenon. Its post-war incarnation had emerged from the missionary medical traditions of the 18th and 19th centuries, but it was also a response to the secular international health system which had developed over previous decades. The international networks of Catholic health, relief, and humanitarian organisations, which had begun to emerge during the early 20th century, underwent a period of rapid expansion during the 40s and 50s. During the same period, Catholics played an active role in global debates about health, humanitarianism, and human rights, as well as the emergence of secular or international organisations such as the UN. But while many Catholics were enthusiastic advocates of post-war internationalism. Others saw secular international institutions as a threat to global Catholicism, worrying in particular about the material values and the growing emphasis on technical development. One of the main lightning rods for these concerns, as we'll discuss in a second, were the population and birth control policies being developed by the WHO. Now, one of the most important examples of Spanish involvement in Catholic international health was Spain's Catholic Nursing Association, Salus Infirmorum, which is, you can see here, and this is the organisation that produced the map I mentioned a second ago. And Salus Infirmorum was led by a leading Spanish nurse called Maria de Madariaga, who you can see here, with loads of babies who weren't hers. For Madariaga and her colleagues, the need to act internationally was an unavoidable response to the increasingly globalised post-war world. As one of the organisation's leaders told Spanish nurses in 1950, quote, "The fact of the immense importance of international agreements brings with it the necessity for Catholics to be present within international organisations." And this idea was reflected in the prominent role Spanish nurses played in the International Catholic Nursing Association, SICAMS, which is the International Catholic Committee of Nurses and Medical Social Assistance, which, as you can see, again, is still going strong today. But the international work of Spain's Catholic nurses was at least in part a response to the perceived threat of post-war international health. For many leading Spanish nurses, these impressions draw on a history and rhetoric of the Spanish Civil War and on fears about the supposed global threat of atheism, communism, and materialism. A Spanish report on the 1951 SICAMS conference described the need for Catholics of the world to unite, quote, "in the face of the wave of materialism which threatens to engulf everything," end quote. Global anti-Catholic forces, according to this view, were gaining power and influence through their domination of international organisations. At a Salus Infirmorum conference in Madrid in 1950, a Chilean nurse described to her Spanish colleagues the plight of Catholics in Latin America and in the world in general. Increasingly surrounded, she said, by Freemasonry, Protestantism, materialism, American modernism, and to finish with the isms, atheistic communism. These ideologies, she argued, gained force from the willingness of their adherents to unite on both national and global scales. "We are in the century of popular fronts," she said, "of the trade unions, cooperativism, leagues, federations, etc. The whole world and all of mankind looks to unite to defend its rights and achieve financial and political benefits." In response to the growth of these forms of anti-religious internationalism, she argued, it was the duty of Catholics to come together in the same way and to unify in their fight to defend their faith and their values. This hostility towards modern forms of internationalism was combined with specific fears about developments in international health and medicine. In 1955, leading member of Salus Infirmorum lamented that in many cases, international problems related to welfare, health, children, education were, quote, "studied from the economic and scientific point of view, but not from the moral or religious," end quote. These concerns reflected wider fears that, even within Spain itself, the trend towards collective and state-led forms of medicine were undermining the focus on the spiritual and material well-being of the individual and the relationship between the individual patient and their caregiver. So both for Spanish nurses and for much of the global Catholic nursing community, indeed much of the global Catholic community generally, these concerns crystallised around specific fears regarding the activities of the newly formed WHO. In part, these were general fears based on the relative weakness of Catholic states within the organisation and the lack of specific Catholic representation within its affiliated bodies. The result of this absence, according to one Spanish Catholic nurse, was that the WHO was pursuing its goals, quote, "in a negative, anti-religious way," end quote. For the SICAMS leadership, the WHO's conception of nursing was too materialist, and it needed to be reminded that, quote, "man is composed of body and soul, and only by attending to both can the nurse fulfil her mission." On a more concrete level, these concerns focused primarily on the advocacy of birth control as a means to limit population size. The leading figures within the WHO, including the organisation's first Director General, Brock Chisholm, advocated birth control to deal with what they perceived to be the global population crisis. During the early 50s, a fierce debate raged between those who wanted to develop WHO birth control programmes in countries such as India, and the Catholic Church and Catholic majority states which opposed the promotion of all birth control measures. Spanish Catholic nurses denounced the proposed WHO measures as eugenics and euthanasia, and argued that they stemmed from an organisation in which scientific and technical solutions to social problems were pursued without sufficient concern for moral or religious principles. But rather than turn their back on these anti-religious organisations, the response of Catholics both in Spain and abroad was to actively seek ways of influencing their policies from within. Leading international Catholic organisations in the US, Europe and Latin America led a concerted campaign to secure WHO recognition for SICKAMS and for other Catholic health organisations, to the extent that the issue became a proxy for the wider struggle between the WHO and the global Catholic community during the period. When SICKAMS lobbied for admission after 1946, it was rejected on the grounds that there should only be one affiliated group for each medical profession, and that nurses were represented by the neutral International Council of Nurses. Although SICKAMS was an active member of the International Council, its relationship with it was complicated, and SICKAMS members consistently lobbied, lobbied it to adopt a more spiritual and religious approach to nursing. In response to the WHO's rejection, SICKAMS argued that neutral organisations, such as the International Council for Nurses, only concerned themselves with professional and technical questions, and were therefore unable to represent the moral and humanitarian principles of Catholic nursing, of the Catholic nursing community. In private, the SICKAMS leadership suspected a specifically anti-Catholic bias, with the organisation's president arguing that the WHO feared too much Catholic influence. Eventually, the WHO changed its rules, accepting the plurality of representation for each sector, and admitted SICKAMS as an affiliate in 1954, after which its officials were able to attend the World Health Assemblies and take part in expert committees. And it was SICKAMS representatives, including Spanish ones, working with other Catholic international health organisations and experts from Catholic-majority countries, which led the fight against WHO birth control programmes, helping to limit their scope over the course of the 1950s. So to conclude, I'd like to suggest that the international work of Spanish experts during the 40s and 50s provides us with a new perspective on the history of international health. The forms of international exchange Francoist experts engaged in stretched beyond the liberal international organisations and networks which have dominated much of the historiography. Examining the perspectives of experts from an authoritarian nationalist regime serves to broaden and deepen our understanding of the dark side of internationalism and international health, the forms of cross-border cooperation which brought together fascist, right-wing and conservative forces to shape alternative to liberal and socialist models of international exchange. International cooperation within the Nazi New Order, for example, shows how international health cooperation was perfectly compatible with far-right political beliefs and systems. Francoist attempts to foster inter-imperial forms of cooperation in Africa and quasi-imperial regional identities in Latin America reflected the extent to which, even after the Second World War, European states saw international health as a tool to consolidate their empires and strengthen their imperial status. And post-war Catholic international health reveals the ongoing importance of religion and religious belief within the field. The case of Spain, I think, also highlights the importance of hierarchies and outsiders to the history of international health. Much of this history has been written from the perspective of those states, primarily in North America and Western Europe, which held dominant positions within international organisations. The idealistic rhetoric of equality and inclusion which characterised international health projects in these countries served to occlude the continued importance of power discrepancies and exclusionary practices within international health organisations. Francoists, however, were painfully aware of Spain's status and position on the world stage, and their attitude to international health organisations and networks was shaped by Spain's peripheral and outsider status, whether real or perceived. In many ways, Spain enjoyed an exalted status within the Nazi New Order, for example, but Spaniards in Nazi Germany were still keenly aware of their subordinate position in relation to their German allies. The UN, like the League of Nations before it, emerged as a victors' club of wartime allies, and the status of ex-enemy countries like Spain illustrated the limits of the universal rhetoric of post-war international health. Spanish attempts to forge alternative forms of international cooperation were motivated by a desire to establish Spain as a leading rather than as a peripheral power on the, within the field of international health. The case of Franco-Spain thus brings to the fore the tensions between equality and hierarchy, between universality and exclusion, which played such a profound role in the history of 20th century international health. Throughout the 20th century, international health organisations and patterns of international cooperation were shaped by these tensions between powerful states and international outsiders. Experts and expertise played a crucial role in these conflicts. The idea of international health as a technical undertaking could be used to justify experts' involvement in diverse and often contradictory forms of international cooperation, from the Nazi New Order to the WHO. The global debate about different political models of health and welfare, which took place in the middle of the 20th century, ensured that health experts played a prominent role in liberal, socialist, fascist, and religious forms of internationalism during the period. The commitment to public health as a universal field meant that the membership of international health organisations often outstripped that of political bodies and could be used by international outsiders, such as Franco-Spain, as a gateway into the wider international system. Health experts then helped to fuel the development of competing alternative forms of international health. But they also stood at the epicentre of post-war international tensions between the UN's system's theoretical and rhetorical commitment to universalism on the one hand, and the visible persistence of international hierarchies and outsiders within international health on the other. Ultimately, approaching the field from the perspective of an authoritarian nationalist regime helps to undermine normative accounts of the history of international health. International health cooperation was a feature of 20th century society, which could be yoked to a politically diverse range of professional, religious, national, or imperial interests and beliefs. The history of international health can only then be understood in relation to the parallel and overlapping histories of imperialism, nationalism, and nation states. Thank you very much.